Okay, we're going to start third class in the series. Welcome, everyone. So just to review a little bit what we did the last two times, of course, the first class we began by looking at the basic notion of prayer, what prayer is all about, being a conversation or an encounter with God, and being something that occurs both in a physical form of actually davening and saying words, and also something that, of course, occurs in the heart, being the central part of prayer called Avoda Shebalev. In the second class, we went to a little bit more depth. We began with the basic questions of what is complicated about prayer, what doesn't make sense about prayer, what's difficult about prayer from a philosophical standpoint. What big questions bother us about the nature of tefillah, not about specific words in the siddur or about why we do certain things, but just about the idea of prayer in general. And we looked at various aspects of those. But last class, what we ended up doing was something very interesting, an approach taken by, again, by Seth Kadish in his book, Kavana, and very novel interpretation and approach, which I like very much and I'm going to keep coming back to over and over tonight and tomorrow. But basically, the approach was to have an approach to prayer that makes all of those questions irrelevant, that tells us that it doesn't matter what the answers to any of those questions are, because there's something more fundamental about prayer than any of that, and that's the approach we went with. And the way we explained it was as follows. We looked at various examples of tefillah, of prayer in Tanakh, and we showed that the structure of prayer and the language of prayer are both very similar to the way people talk to other people in Tanakh. So the way people talk to people is the same way that people talk to God. And what we basically concluded from all of those examples, we went through many of them, which proved the point, because both conversations between man and man and man and God employed very unique words in Tanakh that don't appear other places but appear specifically in those two contexts. So that kind of proved to us that there is that similarity in conversation between humans and between God. And what we took away from that was an assumption that we might be able to make. It's not provable, but we might be able to say that perhaps from all these examples of tefillah and Tanakh, we could conclude that God tells us to enter into this conversation or this encounter with Him called prayer. And the purpose of that is simply to develop a relationship with Him. And God is basically telling us, it may not make any sense to you. You may think to yourself, if I know everything, why should I say all these prayers? If I've already decided what's going to be in your life, why should you ask me to do any differently? And on, all the paradoxes of prayer. You could have all of that in your mind, and God says, none of that matters. The only thing, put that all aside, forget about it, it may not make any sense to you. But do it anyways. Why? Because I want a relationship with you. How do you form a relationship? How do we form relationships? By encountering or conversing with other people. We use certain words, we use certain language, we talk in certain ways. And so God says, if human beings encounter other human beings and create relationships, that's the only way they know how to create relationships. I'm going to ask them to do the very same thing with me. Because in order to create a relationship, they have to do it in the way that they know how. And the way that they know how is by conversing with other human beings. So let them do that with me and develop a relationship, even if what they're doing makes no sense. In the end of the day, at least, we will have forged a relationship through that encounter. Very fascinating approach. And I really want to begin with that tonight, because tonight what we're going to do is take another look at the questions and present some answers to those questions. But I want to preface it by telling you that even if you're not satisfied with any of the answers that we explore tonight or next week, which you may not be, because none of them, I think, are fully satisfactory, in the end of the day, you'll still be able to say, even if I can't answer any of these questions, at the end of the day, my encounter with God or my conversation with God still allows me to forge that relationship with Him, even if this endeavor makes no sense. Does that make sense? Okay. So at least we'll come away with that, even if you don't like any of the approaches or any of the answers. So I'm actually going to follow the structure of the way Seth, or Rabbi Kadish, sections off his book, because I think that it makes a lot of sense to do it this way. It's not necessarily chronological, but it's certainly split up in a very logical format. So while I may not actually be using what he says in the book, So if you actually eventually read it and it doesn't match up exactly, don't be surprised. We're not using exactly what he says in the book for tonight's class, but we are going to use the structure of how he lays out the approaches to prayer. So we're going to begin tonight with what he calls the rational approach to prayer. When did the rationalist Jewish philosophers arise? What period of history? The Middle Ages, the early Middle Ages, and on to through later Middle Ages. But basically the Rambam, the Rabag, these were famous rationalists. Today we're going to look at two that are probably a little bit lesser known. So the first approach we're going to try to take is that of Rav Bachya ibn Pekuda. Rav Bachya ibn Pekuda wrote a book called Chovot HaLevavot, Obligations of the Heart. Rav Bachya ibn Pekuda lived in Spain. He lived around the year 1050. Something like that. Very early Rishon. Before many of the other thinkers from Spain came along, he was there. And he wrote this book called Chovot HaLevavot, The Obligations, the Duties of the Heart. So he never actually addresses the questions of prayer. He never actually addresses prayer in specific at all in his book. But it is interspersed throughout the book because it's an important topic for him. So he actually is not dealing with the topic, but we'll explore a few sections from his book that actually do deal with the topic to be able to kind of come away with an approach of what he thinks about the nature of prayer. And if I were to tell you, to preempt it and tell you what question is running through the back of his mind, because he doesn't state it explicitly, if you have your booklet from last week, you can look. If not, there were three questions that were on the sheet that we raised last week. The first question was, God knows what we need or what we want, even if we don't pray. So why pray? Basically, why do we need to tell God what we need or what we want if God knows everything? That was question number one. Question number two and three, which were related, was if God decides that your request ought to be granted, why must you pray for it? If God is going to give it to you anyways, why do you have to approach him in prayer? And the flip side of that, if God decides that your request ought not to be granted, how can you presume to change his will and suddenly convince him through the words of the Siddur that now suddenly you deserve what you're getting? So what was bothering Bachya ibn Pekuda was not the second question, which is actually philosophically much deeper, but the first one. If God knows what we think, why should we express it outwardly, or why should we say it? So let's take a look at the first page in your sheets. I want to just introduce you a little bit to the thought of Chovot HaLevavot before we actually look at what he says about prayer. So in the introduction to his book, he lays out really the groundwork for the entire Sefer, which in his day was very revolutionary. Today we've seen it in many different contexts. We actually looked at it a little bit in Rav Soloveitchik's writings, which is based off Chovot HaLevavot, but he was the first to say this. Let's read the first source a little bit together. In the introduction to his book, he says, in the first line, it's clear to us that man is a combination of soul and body, both of which are gifts to us from God. One of these is visible, and the other is unseen. Of course, the soul is unseen, but we believe that it's there. Because of them, we're obligated to serve God in a visible way and in an unseen way. Visible means the commandments performed by our limbs, such as prayer, fasting, and charity, and studying, and teaching God's Torah, and fulfilling the commandments of Sukkah, Lulav, Tittus, Mezuzah, the building of a fence around one's roof, and anything similar to these things which are visible to man's senses. Very beautiful thought. Rav Bachya ibn Pekuda is saying, if God created two parts to our being, and our entirety of our being is supposed to serve God, then it only makes sense that both those parts of our being, the soul and the body, should have a piece in serving God, should have a way of serving God. Now, he starts off by discussing the mitzvot that are actional, that are external. And interestingly, one of the first ones he mentions is prayer. Is that surprising? Why not? Surprising to me. Off the bat, if he would have said, there's obligations of the heart and obligations of the limbs, and all we've been reading over and over is that tefillah is avodah shebalev, service of the heart. You'd think that it would fall in the second category as something that you do with your soul or with your heart inwardly. But yet he categorizes this as something that you do with your body. But of course, in our first class, we saw Rabbi Soloveitchik, who did the exact same thing. Why did he categorize it as an actional mitzvah? because there is an actional component to tefillah. That's the main question we started the whole series with, was how can tefillah be an avodah shebalev if it's something we do with our body, and we explain the Rav's take on it. But this is chovas halavavah. So maybe he puts prayer in this category because there is an actional component to it. But hang on. Next paragraph. But the inner service of God are the duties of the heart, such as to unify God in our hearts, belief in Him and His Torah, acceptance of His service, fearing Him, submitting to Him, feeling shame from Him. What are the obligations of the heart? All the emotional mitzvot. Yiras Hashem, Avas Hashem, Yichud Hashem, fearing God, loving God, unifying God's name. When you say Shema Yisrael, you're davening, you're saying part of tefillah, quote unquote, but what are you doing inside is you're saying, I believe that there's only one God. So all of those things are things that happen inside of you. Skip down to the third paragraph now. This is the crux of what I wanted to get. I know for certain, says Bach Ibn Pakuda, 1050, that's almost 1,000 years ago, that's pretty amazing. I know for certain that the physical obligations cannot be complete without the heart and soul desiring to do them, and our will to actually perform them. If we doubt that our hearts have to choose God's service and desire it, then our obligation to perform the commandments should also depart from our limbs, because there can be no perfect action without the soul's desire. He's saying, even if there may be mitzvahs that seem purely actional, he listed all of them above, there has to be, he says, an inner component of the soul and of the heart that goes along with it. Because without that, you might as well throw out all the mitzvot altogether. Very, very radical and harsh statement. If you go back again to our first class, when the Rav explained that there are two types of mitzvot, there are actional mitzvot, and then there are actual mitzvot with an inner component. He said that actual mitzvot are purely actional. Very different approach than this. But Bach Ibn Pakuda is saying, if you don't have an inner component to the actional mitzvot, they're worthless. Very harsh position, because after all, if God says do X, and you do X, even if you feel nothing, at the very least you've done what God asked you to do. Very, very radical position here. But either way, that's this position he takes. Now, let's go to source number two. What he does in source number two is he explains a little bit further on this concept, but he's speaking specifically here about the context of prayer. He says, if one is involved in performing one of the obligations of the heart and limbs together, like prayer and praise of God, let him turn his body away from any activities relating to this world or the next world, and turn his heart away from any thoughts that distract him from the idea of prayer. After cleansing himself and washing away all foul matter and filth, and distancing himself from any foul order or anything similar. So there's a physical preparation for prayer. You have to distance yourself. You can't pray next to the garbage can. It's not appropriate. Distance yourself from the physical parts, but then you distance yourself from the psychological, emotional, intellectual things as well. You throw away everything that was bothering you, and you focus solely on prayer. Then let him call to heart to whom he is directing himself in his prayer. What he asks for it, in it, and what he says before his Creator through the words of the prayer and its idea. So you call upon your heart almost. You say, okay, now I'm ready physically, intellectually, now I call upon my heart to be involved as well. Now, let's just read the following three lines. Know that the words of prayer, it's a beautiful line, know that the words of prayer are through the tongue, but its idea should be in the heart. A beautiful encapsulates all of what prayer is about. The words are through the tongue, but the idea should be in the heart. The words are like the body for prayer, but the idea is like a soul. Just an imagery here is absolutely beautiful.
We say that before the Shmon Esrei about let me be able to speak correctly.
That's right. We say, Hashem Sfatai Tiftach V'Yagitotach, God, open up my mouth so that I may speak properly. We're going to speak more about that actually in coming. But this image is absolutely beautiful. The body versus the soul, like the words versus the idea. Your tefillah is like a soul, you know, ascending to heaven. It's an absolutely amazing idea that there's a body of prayer, which is the text, which is heavy, which is the same for everyone else. But inside of that body of text, inside that siddur, there's a soul which you infuse into it. just like God infuses his souls into a body to make, to create life. A beautiful image. So basically, the point of the Chovas HaLevavos that I wanted to show you here is the whole approach to his book is that there's dual components to mitzvah. There's an actional component and an inner component. And that's certainly true of prayer. But what I want to see now here is exactly what he thinks is the inner component of prayer. We did this with the Rav way back when, if you remember. We started by saying there's two aspects. We said there's an inner aspect, and then we asked, what's the inner aspect? So let's see for Chovas HaLevavos, what's the inner aspect of prayer that we're supposed to get to? Again, keep in the back of your mind, I'm telling you that the question he's grappling with, the question he's dealing with, is why pray if God knows everything that we think? Why say it out loud? Go to page number 2. Ve'amru al echad min ha-tzadikim. We'll read this in Hebrew. Amru al echad min ha-tzadikim sha'yomer achar tfilasa. They used to say of a certain one of the tzadikim that he used to say this prayer after he finished davening. Amazing thing that many gedolim recorded their prayers and they actually became incorporated into our tefillah. But this one was not, but it's a very beautiful prayer. This certain tzadik said the following. Elokai, lo nisa'ani la'amod lefanecha tzichli bepchitut arki umiyut yediyati begdulatcha v'ramamutcha. They said that one of the tzaddikim used to say after his prayers, my God, it's not my unawareness of my small worth that has brought me to stand before you, nor that I lack awareness of your greatness and exaltedness. Ki ata ram v'nisa, you are high and exalted. V'ani nikle v'nivze v'katon mish'ol. For you are... Okay, I can't keep going back and forth. Excuse me, I'm going to translate without the bottom, but you can follow along wherever you want. V'ani nikle v'nivze v'katon mish'ol mimcha u'mikroi lecha shevach v'halo. I'm so small, I recognize my smallness in comparison to your greatness. V'kadesh shimcha mekudash b'kolot ha-malachim ha-elyonim ha-kdoshim. Aval nisa'ani al zeh ma'asher romam tani. You've yourself raised me up by asking me to call out to you. This is what Joan was saying before. So when we say Hashem Svatai Tiftach V'Yagitach, you ask God to open your mouth in prayer, what are you essentially doing? You're saying exactly this. You're saying, you're great, I'm so small, how can I even dare to approach you? But you know what? You asked me to, so I'm coming to daven to you. V'hir sheitani l'shabeach et shimcha elyon. You allowed me to praise your holy name. Kefi hakarati otcha v'yediyati b'chvodecha, in the way that I know you, because of course we can't fully know God. But he said, in my minimal capacity of knowing you, I'm allowed to praise you because you asked me to. Okay, go to the next paragraph. We'll read it, let's just read it in English. You know what I need and my ways, and I haven't told you my needs to make you aware of them, but so that I will realize my utter dependence on you and my reliance on you. Here's the key phrase of the whole Chovas HaLevavos. I'll read it again. You know what I need and my ways. Remember I told you the question he's grappling with is, if God knows everything, why should I say prayer? So he says here, you know what I need and my ways. And I haven't told you my needs to make you aware of them, but so that I will realize my utter dependence on you and my reliance on you. Purpose number one of prayer, it's not for God at all, but it's for us. What's the purpose of davening? So that you should come to an awareness of the greatness of God, of your dependence on God, and of how much you rely on God. So Rav Bachman Pakuda flips the whole thing on its head. Your question was, why tell God what you need if he already knows it? The answer is, you're not telling God because he needs to know it all. You're just verbalizing it. God creates a way of you verbalizing for yourself that which you need, and you verbalize it to God in order to make yourself aware of the fact that those needs, you rely on God for them. Whatever you need in this world, whatever you get in this world, all comes from God. You're dependent on him for that. That's the purpose of prayer, according to Bach Ibn Fakut. Reactions? Strange? Counterintuitive? No? Any? Judy?
I suppose I intuitively feel this way. I've talked to God a lot.
Mm-hmm.
in this as I would, not quite to a friend, but...
Similarly. Mm-hmm. The thing is, though, that to me, in a certain way, it's counterintuitive. And we'll come back to it when we finish looking at Bachi Ben Gudah. But if you asked any person on the street who didn't know anything about Judaism, you know, what's prayer all about in any religion? What are they going to tell you? Something to do with God.
Yeah.
In this case, according to Bachi Ben Gudah, it doesn't really have anything to do with God. It has to do with you. The fact that you're saying it to God, whatever that means, is somewhat irrelevant here. If God told you go in a corner and repeat the fact that you rely on God over and over, you would produce the same result. The problem, what's bothersome about this approach is... Okay.
But I don't feel that way.
Okay, explain.
I think that's what he's saying, because he knows he's talking to God.
Okay.
So, yes, it's for us to realize that we rely on God, but it's nonetheless God, and it's not just and God is nebulous, but it's not just a nebulous nothing.
It's not like standing in a closed room. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what Judy is trying to say, or what she is saying, is that part of what you get out of this is your feeling of dependence on God. And part of the way you come to that is by facing God in prayer. It's not just like facing nothing. So yes, while on the surface, I'm glad you took us here, on the surface it seems like all it is some self-serving, self-training type of exercise. Clearly it's not. The fact that God is involved in this conversation, God is the listener, affects how you feel when you speak to God and speak of your needs and of your dependence. So clearly there is a piece of it that's still God-related, even though on the surface it seems totally about ourselves. Okay. Okay, part of the, let's go to the next source and then we'll conclude a little bit more. In this particular source, the Cholos HaLevavos, the Bachi Ben Gudah here, speaks about how important Kavana is in prayer. How important it is to concentrate, to focus, to know exactly what you're saying, to know what you're doing. Now, after realizing what he just spoke about, that the whole purpose of prayer is to evoke some inner emotion within you, to make you feel dependence or reliance on God, it would make sense now to go further into depth about how important it is to feel something in prayer. That's why he says that the whole idea of prayer without kavana, or prayer without emotion, is worthless. Because if the whole purpose of prayer is to evoke a certain emotion within you, namely dependence on God or reliance on God, then without that result, you've achieved pretty much nothing. In other approaches we've taken, at least you've conversed with God. You'd enter into a relationship with God. Even if you haven't evoked any deep emotions or changes in emotions within you, at least you've had that encounter. And if that was the purpose of prayer, then you've achieved something. According to Bachi Ben Gudah, if you haven't felt it, if you haven't had the proper intentions, then you haven't really achieved anything, because the whole purpose of it is to evoke some change within you. Okay, we won't read it inside, but... basically, what I want to do now is show you a little excerpt, just to bring the whole idea of Bachi Ben Gudah's type of prayer into focus. I want to show you an excerpt from a prayer he writes at the end of his book, the end of his sefer. He writes a whole long, but 10-page tefillah, which he calls, by the way, bakasha, a request. And what I want to show you within it is that it's not a request at all. That Bachi Ben Gudah's approach to prayer, being one that's supposed to evoke an emotion of feeling dependent on God, causes him to minimize the importance of bakasha in prayer, of requests in prayer. That what he tries to do, let me rephrase it differently. We started with the question of why tell God what you need? Why ask him for things if he already knows everything that you're feeling, thinking? And we answered by saying it's not about telling God anything, it's about realizing something or feeling something in and of yourself. So,
if you're proposing this premise, do we not believe in the concept that since God knows what we're thinking, mm-hmm. and if we are in fact asking God for something which can change a situation, and we believe that there is in fact a living God who is can act and has the potential to act, isn't that in fact a reason for the prayer? Because we can change what is going on if we can change God's intention, and if by praying we can change God's intention, and that there's a reason for it.
I'm glad you asked your question. I think that you could question at this point what we've seen in Bach Ibn Kuda whether any of that is the case. He's saying that the purpose of prayer is not to get things for ourselves, not to change God's mind, and not to have Him do things for us. The purpose is simply to evoke a certain change in our own emotions. So you could really argue that maybe Bach Ibn Kuda doesn't believe in that type of form of prayer at all. Maybe that's not the purpose or the achievement of prayer in any way. That's what we think about prayer, but that may not be what he thinks about prayer. But hold that thought. Okay? What I was trying to say before was, if the whole purpose is to evoke a certain emotion within us and not to get something from God, not to ask something of God, because of course he knows everything we're thinking anyways, then petitionary prayer, bakasha, takes a much less significant role in our prayers than shevach, hoda'ah, praise and thanks, because if what we're trying to achieve is evoking an emotion of dependence on God, what's the more likely thing you're supposed to speak about in your prayers? God, you're so great, you're so exalted, I'm so small. You're supposed to speak of the nature and the disparity between you and God to evoke that emotion.